Hello, I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is the very best of The Daily Show. On this bonus episode, we'll revisit the hottest topics, the best guests, the funniest interviews of the past week. So please remember to tune in to the regular show, Monday to Friday, 5 p.m. in your Mail Plus briefings, Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify. But for now, enjoy the show. At least we can say one thing. The government's vaccination programme has been a great success, with more than 15 million people already having had at least one jab. The cavalry that Boris Johnson promised would arrive. So why are we still facing lockdown until July? That's a pertinent question asked in today's Mail by Dr. John Lee, a former professor of pathology at Hull York Medical School, who's a recently retired NHS consultant. Well, Dr. Lee, you have been critical of the extent of the lockdown for some time. We see this extraordinarily successful rollout of the vaccine. Were you surprised to learn, I mean, we haven't got the detailed route map yet, but the indications from the Prime Minister that July, maybe June, before we start to even think about normality?
Yes, well, I mean, obviously I'm disappointed to hear the government saying that, but in a way I'm not that surprised, because I think, unfortunately, I mean, the government have had a very difficult job to do over the last year trying to deal with this pandemic, but I feel that they've made their job harder by listening to quite a narrow interpretation of the data. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the government themselves don't really understand a lot of the data they're looking at from the things that they say, but obviously they're relying very heavily on the advice they're receiving from Sage, amongst others, and that's a rather narrow interpretation of the data that is exceptionally cautious, and in my view, and in the view of many others, sort of overstates the severity of the viral threat and the effectiveness of the measures they've introduced, while systematically underestimating the costs of lockdowns. And you put those two things together, and obviously that's a bit of a dangerous medicine. So yes, I'm not that surprised, but I am disappointed.
We've seen in the last day or so extraordinary new figures about the number of people who've had their cancer ops and cancer consultations cancelled. But I'm looking at your piece today. You say the statistics are irrefutable. The infection rate now, 142 cases per 100,000. That's the lowest for 4 months, and deaths amongst people over 80 have fallen by more than 50% since the peak. So you say the interpretation of the figures or the data looking at is too narrow. What are they getting wrong, in your view?
I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, really, but I think in terms of the public presentation of this data, it's been very tendentious. So one of the things that hasn't been emphasised to the public is that every winter we have a peak in respiratory infections, because respiratory viruses do this year on year on year on year. We get a large peak of infections in the wintertime. And this year we happen to have a peak that seems to be mainly composed of COVID cases. But the fact that we get a winter peak isn't at all unusual. I mean, last winter's peak was higher than usual because we had a new virus on the block. And this winter's peak, we've got another winter peak here. But the fact that the NHS is busy in the wintertime isn't exceptional at all. And so I don't think people should be misled into feeling that this is something truly exceptional. When you look back over the last 30 years, there are other years which have had similar death rates to COVID. And of course, what we've never done before is tested COVID, tested on a mass basis for a particular type of viral infection. And we also haven't had a viral infection that's been like this that have been notifiable. So you put those two things together, it tends to exaggerate the apparent severity of the pandemic. And at the same time, as I say, they've been underestimating not just the missed cancer operations, I mean, but other things that are very important for people's lives, cataract operations, hip replacements, all these things, they really matter. And of course, the mental health aspect of it is enormous. I mean, you're asking young people, who may be single, who may be not in a relationship, on their own, to be isolated at home while working for an indefinite period. And that's awful for them. And simultaneously, in the name of protecting old people, you're asking them to be isolated at home and not see their family and not do all the things that make life worth living for them in what may be their last year or two of life. So you put those two things together, that's an awful, awful burden of things for people to carry in the name of stopping a virus that's actually out there now and is in fact not as bad as people had feared it was going to be.
In your piece, you make the point that we now know 225,000 people in England have waited more than 12 months for routine hospital treatment. That's the largest number for more than a decade. But the quite staggering figure that we're now coming to terms with in your piece, it's been referred to in other places, Doctor. By April, NHS waiting lists are on track to reach 10 million. That's a staggering figure. And how much damage do you think that is likely to cause to the nation's health, and then in terms of the physical health, fatalities, and also the economic health of the nation? Do you think the government have got to grips with the scale of this?
I really don't. I think the trouble with it is, as I say, they've been taking advice from their advisors on a very narrow topic. Basically, how can we control the number of apparent COVID cases or the number of positive COVID tests, where they've been pretty much ignoring everything else. I've struggled to understand how people who claim to be public health doctors are quite happy to let a waiting list of that size arise while claiming to be dealing with public health in the best way. Because obviously we could argue about whether they're doing the best thing for COVID. And in fact, there's a lot of argument about whether they are. But to simply ignore everything else simply seems to me to be, to be wrong. I mean, the thing is, it's difficult to quantify, what that waiting list size really means in terms of the nation's health, but clearly it's going to be enormous. And the tragedy really of these lockdowns, which are a very blunt instrument for dealing with viral epidemics and have never been tried before and have never even been considered being tried before they suddenly introduced it, the trouble with the lockdown is that even if the lockdown ended tomorrow, the health consequences of lockdowns will have a very long tail that will probably last several years in terms of mental health and catch-up operations and people dying of cancer who wouldn't die and all these things. So, it's a very big deal having introduced lockdowns, and to introduce them without a proper risk-benefit assessment seems to me to be, really not the way to go. And as I say, it's a blunt instrument, and I think we can deal with pandemics better than we have done with this one, and we should never use lockdowns again.
I just find I was very struck by the analogy you use. You say you're no businessman. Your interest in monetary affairs is strictly medical. The general health of a population tracks the national GDP. The poorer a country becomes, the more illness and disease is prevalent. Well, we now know the economic shock to this nation is probably the worst since the Second World War. Some say far worse than that, perhaps the worst shock for 300 years. How profound an impact is it going to have on the nation's physical health?
Well, I mean, I suppose on one level, it depends how quickly we bounce back from what's been done. But the longer we carry on doing this, I guess the higher the risk is bound to be that the bounce back won't be as great as people were hoping, because they'll have destroyed businesses and they'll have destroyed people's motivation in the meantime. And so potentially it's very serious indeed. I mean, there's a strong correlation between GDP and a nation's health. And obviously the less money there is to go around, the less money we can spend on healthcare, on social care, on looking after everybody who we want to look after. I mean, the tragedy really with the whole COVID crisis is that this is using this method of trying to deal with a pandemic has never been used before. So you would have thought that the government, in terms of coming to its understanding of what the best thing to do is, would want to have the widest range of advice possible, because there are many, many different inputs to this. And unfortunately, what they've done is taken a rather narrow range of advice that's solely focused on COVID. And of course, that doesn't give the whole picture. And, when you look at the bigger picture in terms of economics, healthcare, mental health, children's health, all the rest of it, the picture emerging very strongly is that this is a really, really bad way to deal with these things. And the government could make its own job a lot easier if it broadened the debate and started to take a wider range of opinion, because they'd then be in a position to say, right, well, the data actually, now that we're looking at it in a slightly different way, shows something different than we thought, and therefore it is okay to open up, as I would strongly argue now. But for some reason, they seem to still be wanting to keep the narrow range of advice. I think that's a grave mistake.
All right, that's Dr. John Lee, former professor of pathology at Hull York Medical School, who's written a very powerful piece in the Mail today. Thanks for joining us. Why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk, where you can listen to the Andrew Peer Show free of charge and in full, of course, along with all our other podcasts and our videos, plenty of them. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker, of course, to play Daily Mail News. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex are expecting their second child, and as ever, announced it in their own very unique way. They shared a black and white picture of themselves under a tree, with Harry resting his hand on Meghan's head as she cradles her bump. Our star columnist date, Sarah Vine, describes the couple as uber influences and says the image is extraordinarily intimate. And she joins me now. They do things their own way, Sarah, and that photograph was, of course, very striking on very many front pages today, I would think around the world, actually.
Yes, I think that it just reminded me of that scene in Notting Hill where, Hugh Grant is lying on the bench and, Julia Roberts is resting her head on his lap and she's pregnant. It's like it's sort of straight out of a sort of Hollywood movie. I think what's interesting about Harry and Meghan is that whenever they release these photographs, there's never any eye contact with the viewer. It's always a sort of intimate portrait of them together, lost in their own kind of world. But it's very interesting. It's a sort of odd kind of combination of wanting to, bring in the viewer, but also sort of slightly keeping you at arm's length and making it very clear that, you know, this is not about you, it's about them.
Yeah. I wonder how much we'll see of this child, of course, who will make a little bit of history, because it'll be the Queen's first great-grandchild born in the States.
I know. Do you think if it's a girl, they'll call it Diana?
Well, there's a lot of talk about that on the internet. I think Diana will be in the name, if not the first name, it'll be the second name.
Yeah,
call Elizabeth to try and grovel to the Queen, because they're in such bad odour with Her Majesty.
I think it's nice for Archie, because Archie's on his own and he's away from all his cousins and his family, so I think it would be nice for him to have a brother or sister. I don't know. I mean, I imagine they'll do what they always do, which is that they'll say that they don't want anybody prying into their private life, and then they'll open the door
to Netflix.
People that, I mean, it is with them. It is, you know, this whole sort of privacy argument is, it's very much a one-way street. You know, they claim to want their privacy, but then they do things like this. You know, and that is a kind of paradox, because if you really wanted your privacy, you wouldn't release photographs, very intimate photographs of you sort of frolicking in a glade in California. I mean, the other thing about this is I do think it's a tiny bit insensitive, not insensitive, but in the sense that they clearly don't really, I mean, there's sort of a bit of a tin ear there. I mean, Britain is, you know, locked down in February, freezing cold, everyone's having a miserable time. You know, it would be, they could have done it in a slightly less kind of, oh, look at us and our marvellous life kind of way. But that's what I meant when I said they're uber influencers. I mean, they have that influencer vibe about them, which is that they think that, you know, what they do is so intrinsically fascinating and interesting that people will just want to look at it. And I guess they're probably right. I mean, clearly they are, because obviously why would Netflix pay them all that money, et cetera, et cetera. But it is there's a sort of parallel there with all those influencers sitting in Dubai drinking cocktails and sitting around in bikinis. Going, oh, look at us, aren't we fabulous? Here's my bicep. And it's just the same kind of vibe, if you ask me.
And, of course, they've got to put themselves out there, because they're going to get paid so much money by Netflix and Spotify and all the other media outlets that they need them to have a high profile. So, and hence we'll get more photographs. We'll get, I suppose there'll be another photograph of the holding a bump.
Yes, and you know, we'll all be obliged to print it and write about it and praise it and say how marvellous it is. Whilst at the same time slightly feeling perhaps that, you know, these people are having their cake and eating it. But maybe, you know, good for them. they certainly manoeuvred themselves into a very privileged, nice position where they have all the sort of upside of being royals and famous, but appears none of the downsides. So,
Not for them unveiling a plaque in Milton Keynes on a wet February afternoon.
Exactly. You know,
which is the life of Prince William and the Duchess of Cambridge.
Yes. But I don't know. I mean, I think, no, not in the slightest. I think the world is basically divided into two camps. Those who think that they are, you know, amazing and wonderful and fabulous and that they can do nothing wrong. And then the old cynics like you and me who take a slightly different view. I mean, you know, each to each. But it's nice for them that they're having a baby, especially, you know, after she had a miscarriage last year. And it's, you know, obviously one wishes them every happiness. I just wish they would be a little bit less, self-obsessed about it all. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Sarah Vine. Read her column every Wednesday, of course, in the Daily Mail, and she's often in the paper on other days too. All sorts of leaks coming out of government seem to suggest that hospitality firms, pubs, may be able to serve customers outside by Easter, which falls on the weekend of April the 2nd, but with a full reopening not expected until May at the earliest. Some pub owners have warned the government that those plans for reopening could mean many of them will never reopen and will go ultimately bust. I'm joined now by Tim Foster, who's the owner of Yummy Pubs. Tim, how bleak is it for you if your pubs aren't allowed to reopen in full till sometime in May?
As bleak as it was when we last spoke, to be honest. So, yeah, our cash flow is still predicting that we run out of money by the end of March. So we need to get trading for the end of March, and we need to have be able to be trading in full. As we've spoken about before, I've got a pub with a huge outdoor space that looks over a 26-acre lake. So that one, can I trade it just outside? Absolutely. Would I? Absolutely. Take off the shackles and let me go, and I'll be trading it. But my other three simply wouldn't be viable. Just wouldn't be able to open them and trade it. So it's a crazy idea that's not based on any form of science, again, not based on any form of facts, again, not based on any form of evidence, again. We're just being used as a political football, as we have done throughout this entire pandemic. So to not open us up at the same time as non-essential retail, I want somebody to tell me why, to be honest. I want somebody to give me a report and let me know why, because it's already been proven that we were the best in the world when we reopened and our COVID secure measures put in place. So I'd really just like the speculation to continue. It's fine. It gets us talking about it. It gets people talking and remembering that we're still out here and we're closed and we're forced to be doing different things, which we are, but we are running out of cash. The government grants are landing now. We've had to chase them. We've spent weeks and weeks and weeks chasing money that wasn't paid to us back from November, and so have so many other people in our sector. But that money is beginning to land, so we're getting it, but it still doesn't cover my bills. So every day I stay closed, I just lose money, and I'm losing money at a phenomenal rate. And I need to get open, I need to get trading, and using us as, yeah, political football and putting us on front pages of everything to get the nation back into hoping that they can get into the local. We experienced this back in sort of April, May last year, when everybody was saying, well, the front page of the Sun, you know, head to the pub garden for a beer this weekend. So we have to wait until what he says next week, I think, and play a game. But if they're looking through, as we've been led to believe this morning by Matt Hancock and all of his interviews, that they're looking at the evidence this week to make decisions next week, then I just implore them to look at that and actually look at evidence and look at facts and studies rather than just making this stuff up.
We get the sort of route map from the Prime Minister next week, Tim, but also we'll have a budget in the first week in March. Are you hoping there may be some more financial support announced for the hospitality industry?
There's got to be. There just simply has to be. So we need a stimulus to help us trade out of this, and we helped this country come out of the last recession. We can be the ones to help it again, because it's not just us. We'll be there to facilitate it. The consumer, you know, the people of this country are desperate to socialise again. They're desperate to get out. They've been starved of it now for coming to over a year. We can be there and help it, but we need the stimulus. We need the VAT reduction to remain in place. We need the business rates. You know, again, we were having this conversation last time. It's great not having to pay business rates, but my businesses have been closed more of this year than they've been open. So I shouldn't have been paying them in the first place. So to continuously say that we've been given support in business rates is actually now beginning to be a bit grating, where they need to start saying we've come up with new plans, new measures. And that's what I'm expecting the Chancellor to do when he stands up. He's proven in his report that was commissioned by the Treasury that Eat Out to Help Out wasn't responsible for the second spike. So he now needs to believe in us like he did before, and give us the support to reopen. And we just implore him to continuously think about who he's going to be helping, because we can help this nation come out of it. And it's not me. I speak on behalf of the smaller operators that don't get the opportunity to talk to people like you. And it's them that we have to worry about, because there are vultures circling. You know, there are some big money boys coming to the market to pick up distressed assets. So when people keep on saying the pub won't survive, that's rubbish. The pub will always be here, but it'll be under a different guise. And if you want it to be operated and run by people who care passionately about the building and the people in it, they're the independent operators. And at the moment, those people are the people that have been put under serious, serious pressure by not getting the support. And they are the lifeblood of our industry. They're the reason that people move into the sector, and they need to be protected. So he just needs a stimulus. Give us the opportunity to run at it. let, you know, just don't put these restrictions on us that we had last time. You and I sitting in a pub with a scotched egg was funny for the front page of a newspaper. It was soul destroying for the 3 million people we employ.
Just finally, Tim, maybe you should invite Sir Patrick Vallance and Chris Whitty, the Chief Scientific Officer and Chief Medical Officer, to your nice pub for a pint and show them so they can see for themselves how COVID-friendly most pubs in Britain have become.
Day or night, any time of the day, any day they want, any notice they want to give me, whether it's 5 minutes or 5 hours, they can come here. And I'll show them, and I'll be very respectful, and I'll bite my teeth, and I'll show them everything that we're doing.
Yeah.
And they may not want to drink alcohol. They may just want a cup of tea. But believe it or not, we'll sell as much tea and coffee, pretty much as we sell of alcohol as well, because people come here to meet one another, meet friends, enjoy each other's company. They do not come here to get absolutely blottoed and put pressure on the NHS. So, yes, they are more than welcome, as are you, my friend, to come down.
Well, I tell you, I'm going to find your nice pub with all the acres of land and the lake, and I'm going to come and have a pint with you. And I won't be drinking tea, by the way. I will not be drinking tea.
You're more than welcome, whatever you want.
I look forward to it. All right, that's Tim Foster, who is, of course, the owner of Yummy Pubs, talking about what happens next. The government has announced plans for a free speech champion to ensure universities in England don't stifle freedom of expression. But is there really a freedom of speech crisis on our university campuses? The human rights campaigner Peter Thatcher has experienced of attempts to no-platform him no fewer than three times. He's not being no-platformed here, that's why he's joining us. Peter Thatcher, is there a crisis in our universities? Because you're not alone in being the subject of attempts to no-platform you. I'm thinking of Jenny Murray, a doyen of Woman's Hour for more than 30 years on the BBC, who now writes a column in the Mail. She pulled out of an event at Oxford University because of an attempt to no-platform her.
Well, I think certainly there is a problem, but I think it is somewhat exaggerated. There were two pieces of major research, one by the BBC and the other by the Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights in 2018, and both concluded that there was a problem, but it was very small, and the allegations were inflated. Now, of course, that doesn't make them right. You know, freedom of speech is one of the most important and precious of all human rights, so we do have to defend it, but we need to put it in perspective. And my fear is that this proposal by the government is part of its cultural war strategy. As we know from leaked documents some time ago, the Conservatives do have a strategy of using hot-button culture topics to try and undermine the opposition and to win support among voters who perhaps hold rather old traditional views. And I'm afraid that I think that this particular proposal for a free speech champion, although okay in principle, is part of that cynical culture war strategy.
I'm not quite sure about either is quite how it would work. I mean, the champion, the free speech champion would regulate no platforming of speakers, but the National Union of Students don't want this. Do you know how it would work? I mean, they would presumably be based in the Office for Students. And if there was a row over no platforming, they intervene and then instruct the university to allow the speaker to take part or not. Is that your understanding? Because that would take away a lot of your autonomy for the universities, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. But like you and everyone, I think we are very confused and uncertain about what this proposal means in practice. It's, you know, at one level, it's high sounding and the right thing to do. But the other hand, how would it actually be enforced? And I think the danger is that we would give to a government-appointed free speech champion quite authoritarian, autocratic powers to make very major decisions over what can be said on university campuses. And the concentration of that power in the hands of one individual and indeed the Office of Students, which is a part, that would be, I think, a step too far.
What was the issue they wanted to prevent you from speaking on, Peter Thatcher? Can you remind us?
Well, there was one famous incident at Canterbury Christ University where I was due to speak and the NUS speaker decided that I was, quote, racist and transphobic and that she would not appear alongside me. And the insinuation that some people in the university got was that basically she was saying, either ditch Tatchell or I won't appear. Now, of course, I defend her right to not share a platform with me. But when challenged, she couldn't provide any evidence of racism or transphobia. So in the end, she didn't appear, but I did. So I wasn't no-platformed, but that's sort of the way in which sometimes things do happen in certain universities.
But there are other occasions, aren't there? I mean, you will know Julie Bindor very well. I know her very well. She writes for The Guardian a lot. She's a feminist. She's a gay feminist writer. She was no platform because of her stance on trans. Her view is pretty clear. You're a woman or you're a man, and she's upset the trans lobby. Now, she was no platformed. Should she be no platform just because she may hold views on the trans community that aren't shared by all the people who run perhaps the National Union of Students at that particular university?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. The National Union of Students does have a no platform policy, which was initially introduced in the 1970s to counter violent far-right extremism. It has since been expanded to include only six organizations, and these are quite extreme organizations. So the NUS, the National Union of Students, does not have a blanket no-platform policy. Some individuals or individual student unions or societies have sought to expand it, but that is not the policy of the National Union of Students. I would say that, you know, the way to look at it is this. Freedom of speech is one of the most important and precious of all human rights. There has to be really strong, compelling reasons to take it away or to limit it. And I would say there are three legitimate reasons to restrict free speech. First, if someone makes false, damaging, and harmful allegations, like that someone's a rapist or a paedophile or a tax fraudster, that can cause that person real harm. Second, if a person engages in harassment, threats, or menaces. And thirdly, if they incite violence. Now, in these three instances, allowing that kind of speech would actually close down free speech because the people being victimized would then be afraid to stand up and defend themselves. And that is obviously not the way to go. In all other instances, I would say the best way to defeat bad ideas is with good ideas. You know, my strategy has always been to challenge bigots, but whoever they are, challenge them to present counter-arguments, counter-evidence, to show why they're wrong. I think that is much more effective than banning someone. Banning someone doesn't challenge them. It doesn't make their ideas go away. It doesn't engage with their followers. And I have been on a number of events where challenging bigotry has actually led to at least some of their followers rethinking following that person because they've heard a counter argument. So I think, you know, it's really important that we don't let bigoted ideas pass, but the best way to do that is to challenge them.
Just a thought, Peter, and a counterintuitive thought. You and I have known each other for many years. The government will, I'm sure, appoint this free speech champion. Perfect job for you, my dear.
Well, I'm not going to put myself forward. There are many others.
Well, you'd be rather good at it, though, wouldn't you?
Well, I will leave that to other people with greater expertise in the field, and in particular with university experience, which I don't have. But I would also add that the government, what's also worrying about these proposals is that this proposal comes from a government which itself stands accused of trying to limit free speech. So we've had multiple cases where the government's anti-terrorism program Prevent has been abused. So I'm thinking of the example of a postgraduate student who was researching terrorism and legitimately downloaded the Al-Qaeda manual from the US Department of, I think the US Department of Defense website, and then was hauled up arrested and detained on terrorism related issues. Also, the other big issue at the moment is the government's opposition to any serious questioning of Britain's colonial history. Now, whatever side you take on this issue, the idea that the government can be, or government ministers or individual conservatives, are saying that this shouldn't be discussed, that this questioning of Britain's colonial past should be off limits. That, to me, is also a threat to free speech.
Peter Tatchell, irrepressible, impossible to ignore, and always got plenty to say. So one sector which has had a pretty bad time in the pandemic is the freelance category. Some saw their earnings dip by half, with 58% of the UK's 5 million self-employed saying they had much less work than normal. Many more are thinking, according to recent data, 1 million people are planning to give up being self-employed because they saw their income fall so much. But income coach Lisa Johnson says it's possible to find success even in these testing times. And if the proof's in the pudding, it's her. She made over £2 million in 2020 after being £30,000 in debt 3 years ago. And she joins me now. Lisa, I'm going to hang on your every word. How do you do it?
How do I do it? It's basically about using the knowledge that you already have in your head to put things out on the internet. Because what we've realised in 2020 is that, yes, we might not be able to sell in the normal way, but actually more people are buying things on the internet that they wish to learn. And so if you want to be one of those people making money, you need to be offering something on the internet that people can learn. And everybody knows something, right?
I guess they do. What was it you put on the internet that you know so well?
So I teach people how to start and scale their businesses online. So exactly what I was just talking about is what I teach. But some of my clients, I've had over 2,000 clients in 2020 who, you know, otherwise would not be able to work. The wedding sector is a huge one that I've had to help out because they couldn't go back to work. Singers couldn't go back to work. So we look at what they already know, and it might not be to do with what they did in a past job. It might be something else that they know. For instance, parenting, you know, dating. It could be about assertiveness. It could be life coaching. There's so many different things. Just taking one of my clients who was a singer, we sat down and said, well, what else do you know how to do? And she said, well, I was a singer, so I'm really confident on stages. Well, there are tons of entrepreneurs that need to be confident when they go on stages to do TEDx talks and that kind of thing. So she started a business teaching them how to be confident on stages, and she's made, you know, multi-six figures in 2020 because of it. So there are lots of things we can do. We just need to maybe think a bit differently than what we normally do and think about our transferable skills and how we can sell online with those.
What would you do, though, with, say, somebody who's running a pub? Terrible time for anybody who owns a pub, Lisa, or a restaurant. I mean, I guess if you're a restaurant, you might be able to operate a takeaway business, but a pub must be pretty bleak. Could you do anything for a publican?
Yeah, well, I've had quite a few people who run restaurants help with things like, for instance, there was one lady I had who is good at Caribbean cooking. So she's been teaching people online how to make, you know, different Caribbean dishes. And she has a membership where people can pay her money and each week they learn a different thing. With people who run pubs, I would be slanting them more towards the people that run pubs. They know about customer service. You know, that's the thing they're good at. They're good at how to run a business where food and drink is involved. There are lots of people that are going to be setting up those things. And the ones that are, this year is the year that they're taking out to learn about it before they do it. So it's same with wedding industry. Even though there's no weddings going on at the moment, there's lots of people who during the pandemic have decided they don't want to go back to the job that they've been furloughed from. They don't want to go back to an office. It's made them completely rethink. And the first thing that new businesses do when they come into the market is they learn from somebody else that's been there. So if you've already ran a pub, you've already been a hairdresser, you know, you've already opened a restaurant, you have a lot to teach new entrepreneurs that are coming in. And at the moment, we have an entrepreneurial gold rush. More entrepreneurs than there have ever been in history are starting up. And the first thing they're doing is looking online for help.
Fascinating stuff. And I imagine, Lisa, some of the people may find they rather like this new way you've repositioned their businesses, and they may just not go back to it and may stay doing
happening.
What they're doing. Is that what's happening, do you think?
Definitely. I've had quite a lot of people that were yoga instructors, you know, people that were helping people with back pain, all of those kind of things, therapists that were doing things on a, you know, in-person basis that have now taken their entire businesses online and can now work one to many instead of one to one. They can teach lots of people at the same time how to help with their problems, and they've decided not to go back to doing the in-person they were doing. They don't need the office. You know, they can do it all from Zoom, and they can help more people, so have more impact.
How does it feel going from £30,000 in debt 3 years ago to making over £2 million?
Crazy. It feels crazy. It wasn't something I expected when I started in business 3 years ago. I was just hoping to be able to make enough money that I didn't have to go back to my 9-to-5 job because I had twins. I didn't expect that so many people would, you know, need at this time to learn how to operate businesses online. You know, that's what happened in 2020, and it changed everything for me.
Amazing. What was your 9-to-5 job?
I was a PA. I was a personal
really?
Assistant. Yeah.
Right. I bet your boss, who you were PA to, a bit jealous now, isn't
well,
he or she?
I left because of him, because he wasn't nice person, but I was on the my article was in Forbes magazine, and they put me on the cover last
How
year.
How fabulous is that?
I sent it to him with a little note saying, thanks for being who you are, making me leave my job.
Did you get a reply, Lisa?
I didn't.
Funny that. How funny. Well, it'd be awfully funny if he lost his job and he then came to you for advice.
It would be funny, wouldn't it?
What would you say? Get a new personality, mate.
Yeah, something like that.
Fantastic stuff. That's income coach Lisa Johnson, who's giving great advice to lots of people in these testing times. If you're a freelance, it's not all bad. Well, that's all from the Best of the Daily Show with me, Andrew Pearce. Remember, you can tune into the regular show Monday to Friday at 5 p.m. on Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify. Have yourselves a great weekend, and goodbye.